And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Philippe Matthews Radio Show. Thank you for listening, tuning in wherever you are around the world. She's back with us, Dr. Jacqueline Battalora, the author of Birth of a White Nation, The Invention of White People and Its Relevance Today. Dr. Battalora is an anti-racist writer, attorney, and professor of sociology and criminal justice at St. Xavier University in Chicago, as well as a former Chicago police officer. So don't mess with her because she's badass. Welcome back, Doc.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Philippe.
So in this conversation, we're going to talk about, and we have really unpacked a lot. I mean, we did Bacon's Rebellion. We talked about anti-miscegenation. We talked about the actual birth of white people, the invention of white people. This time we're going to talk about something interesting, and that is the invention of race. Because one would think, and in my naivete, thought that, well, between that 1664 and 1681 that we talk about on our conversations, within our conversations of how these laws came to be, there would be the assumption that there would be the classification of race. But when we talk about how that has become, how does that become institutionalized in a society, you say, no, that took some time to do. And that's what we're going to be talking about today is the invention of race.
Right. Yeah. So I know that it can be for us in this 21st century in the United States. It seems as though this concept, this way of thinking about humanity as races, that has always been the case, but it simply hasn't. Mm. The label race, the way of thinking about human groups as reflecting races, didn't emerge until 100 years after the invention of white people, which of course first appeared in 1681.
Wow.
Excuse me. 100 years. Yes. Yeah. So we know from the invention of white people that people were thought of as being in different groups, that way of thinking began to take hold with the invention of white people. And people before the invention of white people were rhetorically referenced in these sort of group labels. Negro was the first terminology for persons of African descent, and Indians. So linguistically, groupings were reflected, but people were not understood as different in the way of thinking that the concept of race then morphed into. So let's dive into when this way of thinking about people called races came about. Mm-hmm. As I was mentioning to you in the green room, as we say, even on the radio, at really the very moment when the American Revolution was taking place was also a moment when I hesitate to call them scientists, but they tended to be physicians and naturalists, I think is perhaps the best label for them. But Carlos Linnaeus. Was one of the first, and he helped to develop a system for organizing living natural our natural world, class, order, genus, species, and so he was one of the first to start this classification of nature. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the latter part of his life that he began to apply this to humans. And so all of these naturalists, I'm trying to remember the name of the German,
Blumenbach.
Starts with a B, Blumenbach. My apologies, I should know
Blumenbach.
The name.
Yeah, Blumenbach.
Thank you. Yes, he became quite well known as a naturalist as well, and so these naturalists were busy categorizing, and then they began to apply it to humans. And it's important to note that all of these naturalists were themselves within this group called white people, and they simply drew, you know, we think of science today as being based upon observable, you know, heavily controlled experimentation, and nothing that they called science to justify viewing humanity as races would hold up as science today. So we should be very clear. Mm-hmm. But what they did was they took ideas about different groups of people. Not very rarely was it from direct observation, which is an initial problem. Mostly they tended to draw upon the logs of explorers. So other white people who were exploring the world through ship travel.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were relying on these journals as a source of information about other people. And of course, you know, it's not surprising, I don't think, that their ordering of humanity reflected sort of the social structure of their moment as Europeans. So white people at the top, in other words. And so they assigned qualities to these groups of people. And of course, the most admirable qualities were attached to white people who looked like them, and less desirable ones to various non-white groups. And Blumenbach's categorization, because he used Caucasian as this label for white, and it, this, I think, kind of helps us put into perspective this whole entire body of so-called science that has been used to justify humans as racial groups. And that is this, that his use of the label Caucasian came out as the reason he used it and then put white people in it was that the most beautiful skull in his collection came from a woman in the Caucasian region. So,
wow.
Because it was the prettiest skull.
That's highly scientific right there.
Exactly. That's why I love that little piece, because it really helps put in perspective these claims to science. Okay, so we get it, right? So we get that you have these people, the pseudoscience that's emerging. And don't forget, we are now in the Enlightenment. So the whole paradigm in Western civilization is shifting away from God as the authority now to science as that which justifies truth, that which speaks truth and tells truth. Okay, so in the mix of this, we have the emergence of an entirely new country called the United States of America. And with the Enlightenment, we had two impulses that were very significant. One was this natural, what they would call natural law.
Mm-hmm.
And we see lots of natural law clauses in our founding documents. Things like all men are created equal, claims of liberty for all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's natural rights and natural law kind of language that was part of the philosophies that emerged in the Enlightenment. So that's one impulse. The other impulse was this tendency to authorize or legitimize truth claims through science, through direct observation, although we know that was missing from the pseudoscience I just referenced. So here's what we see in founding U.S. documents. We see these two contrary things that are at play in the U.S. Constitution. All men are created equal and other natural law kind of claims, and an affirmation of slavery. How the heck did smart people... How were they okay? The question becomes, like, how can that be? Like what?
Here's the cognitive dissonance that we talked about.
I was just going to say, and here we're back to cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
So if I had over the summer, I was reading the Congressional Congress to the extent I could find records of exchanges there about those who were supporting slavery and those opposed to slavery. And reading what they had to say, and nowhere could I find a reference to race. And actually, that was consistent with what I expected. And the one place I found use of the language race was by Thomas Jefferson in his, letters or I'm trying to remember the title of the book about the state of Virginia,
mm-hmm.
on the state of Virginia, I think is the text. And in there, I see one of the first references to race. And in fact, in 1790, the brand new country, like the first Congress met in 1789 and 90. And in, I believe it was 1790, they required that a census be taken. So they know their people who fell within the boundaries of this new republic. And this census, the census has no reference to race.
Mm, wow.
So again, we see that this, the very, even just the language of race was just emerging. And again, one of the primary carriers of the idea of race was, in fact, Thomas Jefferson.
That's
fascinating. This nation's
third. You and I did a show together with Michael Pillman on race technology. And
yeah.
We were talking about Thomas Bialosi and, you know, the four aspects of race technology is classifying, stating, mixing, and spacing. And Thomas Jefferson was used as the example of stating. And so I think what you're talking about in terms of his records was when he started talking about race and started stating, which was the beginning of, if you will, this now well-oiled machine called racism or scientific racism, or institutional.
Absolutely, racism. Absolutely. And so, I'm trying to pull all these pieces together, and I know they're not readily clear how they fit together. So let me keep building, and then hopefully
you're doing great on this part. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, good. So we have this natural law claims all people are created equal at the same time that these same documents protect slavery, right? Because the Constitution didn't allow for the abolishment of slavery until a later time. So it wasn't even a possibility. So how do you resolve these? Well, if through cognitive dissonance, you have made this group of people who, by the way, you in Thomas Jefferson's instance, you have hundreds of that you have rendered slaves. If you have made them something less than human,
mm-hmm.
then you know, maybe they don't quite that claim of being created equal doesn't really apply to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so don't forget that in the Enlightenment period, the way that truth claims get to hold a status as truth is through science. And so conveniently, Linnaeus, Blumenbach, and Jefferson himself, who was into classification, was one of these sort of on the side scientists as well,
mm-hmm.
Produced the science, which today we would call pseudoscience, that worked to give that authority and justified this claim or the proposal that persons of African descent are in fact lesser than Caucasians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so all of this came together to, and of course I can't even say the words. It just isn't right. Right. But for them, it worked to appease this conflict. between the natural law claims and the endorsement of the enslavement of persons of African descent.
So there was this, you know, there was this constant fight between morality and humanity, and economics, because the slaves represented, that was their economics. That was how the country made money.
But you know what's crazy to me is that, I mean, obviously, even
we have to first deal with, and this is just my opinion, we just had to first deal with the psychopathy. It was just a collective psychopathy that went viral, because you have to be out of your mind to do something like that, and to institute it, and to follow it, and to create an entire, and to give it to the entire population. Healthy, mentally healthy human beings don't do that. So this is why we're having this conversation, and why I love the work that you have done over and above, Theodore Allen and Edgar Morgan, because you have brought with your work the humanity and morality in the research, where that is missing in some of the earlier works, even though you have researched that, and it's an integral part of our history and our working through this. But you brought the humanity back. You brought the morality back and the sanity back into the conversation, and really have made that dichotomous. It's like, okay, this is not these are not normal people, and we're living right now intergenerational disease. White people are in a sense just as much victimized by this as we are, more so than us in terms of the actual physical outcome, but the mental outcome for you, for white people, is you're constantly battling your morality.
That's exactly right. I call it, I like to refer to it as that whiteness, white institutionalized white superiority has truly damaged, significantly damaged our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Our capacity to be in the shoes of another, of color.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, let's be clear.
Absolutely. It's real. So let's go back. So I didn't want to interrupt you. I had to intercede in that and say that, you know, we have to look at this, the beginning of this, and say these people were out of their freaking mind. And the classification, the medical classification of a sociopath or a psychopath can be readily attributed to the people who created these laws, instituted these laws, and made these laws the lay of the land, to continue to look for reasons to justify the enslavement and the dehumanization of a people, and to create a third class. It's absolutely diabolical. And I think what people are afraid to admit is when we look at maybe all of the actions and language of the 45th, we get to see that psychopathy blatantly thrown in our faces one tweet at a time.
Yes.
And the mic drops. And
yes, I know. What?
And the room goes silent, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, well, you got to sit with that one.
Yeah.
I had flashes of different tweets going in front of my eyes, so it was taking a little bit to absorb it all.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's a conversation. It's a hard, you know, you and I, we have hard conversations. This is what the show is dedicated to. And it's not emotional. It's just, this is really the science of it.
You think about this concept of race and how important it has been, right? Because we already had these groups that were seen as having as different groups, right? So it doesn't seem entirely crazy to shift over to this thing called race. But what that shift did was it rooted it in what they called science, but we would today call pseudoscience. And the result is that for generations, people born into these so-called racial categories believe it's biological.
Mm-hmm,
and it's
mm-hmm.
not.
It has worked.
It has worked to perpetuate that lie. And it does it today. I mean, you can't find a form without this category, you know, without clicking off a category.
Mm-hmm.
As if it's real in the sense of biological real. And let me make something clear. Having lower or higher levels of melanin in one's skin is a reflection of a biological reality.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what people miss. If racial groups were biologically real, we would find definitive ranges of melanin. We'd find sharp markers that divide and separate groups in these categories. And it simply doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we use melanin as one of the markers, there are ranges of melanin within each of the different groups that overlaps with the other groups.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there is no
there's no line
biological,
of demarcation.
No genetic support for these things called race. They are just like the category white. They are an assertion of power and control and subjugation and empowerment.
Now, what I want to do right now is, I really, if I could, and if you can, I really want to get these dates because this is very important. You know, we know from 1664 to 1681, the anti-miscegenation law came into play and became substantiated in 1681, and kind of like it started in 1664, but it really became substantiated in 1681. And that was when there was, and it was a cluster of these laws, but three of the most powerful, as you have trained me very well, I must say, Doctor, and that I repeat on my show, and other guests on my show are learning this as well, that one, a person of African descent could not vote because prior to that they could. They could run for office. They could no longer run for office. Even though there was no mention in the archives that they did, but if they wanted to, they could have, because there was nothing to stop them from doing so. They could not own gunpowder or guns, which was another huge significant one, especially back in that time, when that was how you protected your life, your family, and in some cases made your living, because you had to, you know, this country was already taken. And then you had to work and be protected by everybody was trying to kill you. Thirdly, though, however, or fourthly or whatever, was the classification of white was created at that time. And the accompanying law said that a person of African descent could not sue this new designation of white.
Couldn't testify against them. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and we've had
which made very clear the legal system's position in relation to white people versus people of color, and we continue to see manifestations of it to this day.
And so, when you think of that, you know, that year, that time, that moment when that was first put into the public place and how that was propagated. Yeah, it's the beginning, but it took 100 years to for it to, if you will, to mature, to manifest as an actual state of culture, an actual manifestation of collective psychopathy, and. It's very diabolical in a sense, because you're raising people, you know, children born are now, you know, being socialized. The question is, you know, which came first, chicken or the egg, right? So we have this conversation. Are all white people bad? Can the people who harmed us the most do us the most any good? And so, you know, we see a child born innocently. You know, how do they come up and become, you know, racially aggressive through mm-hmm. socialization? But the problem is that, you know, these SOBs back in who took the country, you know, back in the 1400s, this is what we're dealing with. And you're born into, it's like the Matrix. It's like you're born into this lie called America. And if you're lucky, you'll grow up and you will become a Battleora or a D'Angelo or a Wise or an Elliot. And you'll be white and you'll recognize something here ain't right with this thing called white. And depending upon what time and where you and place and your area of study, you will say, you know, where did this come from? But most of them don't know where this comes from, which is why your work is radically powerful and necessary and needed, because you give the actual historical dates and almost times, if you will, when this started, and say, oh, because now we're kind of trying to, you know, explain an effect with an effect, and we never get to the cause. You're able to get to that cause. Here's what caused it. But now we know from 1681 on, this is how this began to develop into this thing called race technology and the emergence of race 100 years later.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think actually sort of the shift from different groups imbued with different assumptions about their value, mm-hmm. which began to be the case starting with the invention of white people. And I think the shift of that into race, race just became the moment, the Enlightenment moment, presented new requirements. And so it offered a new scheme for how to justify that setup. And we've had millions more. I mean, as you were speaking, I thought of Michelle Alexander's work. And, you know, one of the things that she cautions, and I think it's so important, is the flexibility of white supremacy to reshape itself in the new moments, the new pressures of new ways of thinking, of new language, but nonetheless to persist and to find new ways to dehumanize non-white people and mm-hmm. confer unearned advantage on white people, its ability to do that and to morph and into the constraints
like,
and the possibilities
like,
of a historic
like,
moment are incredible.
Are you
just
saying
incredible.
Like presidential pardons? Are you saying like?
Well, I'm saying
you're not talking about that, are you?
But I left that. Then I am talking about sort of the broad culture and because we all play a role in it, you know, in the like think about it in yours and my lifetime, Felipe. We have seen this mass incarceration. It has been a it has been part of our life.
I have seen
right?
my friends and family vanish off the planet.
And so it's white supremacy that molds to a new moment in a new way, right? And it's, you know, what the hell? I mean, why did it take the incarceration of this many people? Why did it take Michelle Alexander's writings? For so many in our nation
well,
to say, oh my God, look what we've
done argument.
Again.
Here's an argument. And that is, you know, I've had other scientists on, such as Dr. Edwin Nichols, 50-year veteran of philosophy and created the philosophical aspects of cultural difference. And he is an axiologist, and axiologists study human values and how the environment shapes our DNA and modifies mm-hmm. us genetically. And there's this new science called epigenetics, which is basically genetic memory. And so there is an aspect to this, whether it was back then known or not in terms of just the biology of people, but those are our ancestors born into this, both black and white, in terms of this new designation in the category. The environment of institutional white supremacy has a biological genetic effect. It alters our DNA. And so this is why a lot of African-Americans will never trust the new designation of white people, and vice versa, if white people won't trust black people, because of being born into what you're socialized in. And I had Dr. Luann Brizendine on the show, who is an incredible genius of mine in hormonal neurobiology. And she wrote two best-selling books, The Female Brain and The Male Brain. She was on Oprah, and The Female Brain now is going to be made into a movie. And I asked her the question. This was during the time when the 45th was running for election. And I asked her, can hate be hardwired in the brain? And she said unequivocally yes. And that floored me. Because now that supported the axiology of Dr. Edwin Nichols and shaping the human value system and the nervous system and how it responds to the environment and the stimulus in the environment. But then now she's saying at the brain level, this can be hardwired. So when we look at KKK and all of the hate groups and organizations in the country, we can look at it from a genetic perspective. And I remember saying to you, when you and I having the conversation on my live show, that the election of the 45th, I said that it was a genetic response. And I said it because I just felt that there was something more than meets the eye for the fact that CNN and all of these other news stations could not predict and know where these people came from. I had one of the top demographers in the country, Kenneth Bronbach. I had him on my radio show. And his work is, you know, over the last 30 years, he just counts people, and he has all of these predictions. And he says, Philippe, all of the demographers that I have worked with, we missed this one. We could not predict it. I said, really?
Mm-hmm.
They got everything else right, but they couldn't even
right.
The top scientists. And so when Dr. Brizendine said that, I asked her the question, can you ask someone and say, hey, are you a racist? And they can look at you and say, no, I am not. And not even if they were under a, what do you call that thing, a lie detector, it wouldn't register because it's
right.
So cellular. It's who they are at the genetic level. They don't know. So what I'm saying and what I'm getting at, to even further substantiate the work that you've done, is that this is such a well-oiled machine that when you are born into this system, that it starts to there's an also called the in epigenetics. It you and me are living our parents, our parents, three generations ago. That's how deep genetically it manifests itself. And what you're doing right now will affect three generations from now.
It's fascinating.
So this is
absolutely
a very well-oiled machine. And so
when
this is why your work is so radically important to me, because we need that anomaly. We need that shift in the DNA. We need that thing in the matrix that break. We need the Neo, right? Your work is the Neo in the matrix. It has to be broken. And so in order to change that DNA, we have to create an axiological epigenetic movement with this work of education. And all it takes is education. Now, here's the interesting thing, Dr. Battalora. Dr. Edwin Nichols says it will only take one generation to change it. 500 years, it will only take one generation. If we now this new generation of Generation Y that's coming out, it's going to be 86 million of them, largest in history, bigger than the baby boomers. They're the ones that can absolutely unequivocally change all of this in one generation. So the work that you're doing is I can't. When I say your work is so necessary, it's just not blowing smoke up your whatever. It's really serious. I know from other studies, other talks, other experts, what can be done and how imperative this work is. So it took, and just think about this, it took 100 years from 1681 for this machine to really kind of manifest, for people being born into it. And we've had this conversation where you said, well, who the hell is going to go for these classifications? I mean, I wake up tomorrow morning and all of a sudden I'm white and you're Negro, and who's going to, in a society where everybody was, in a sense, equal, who's going to go for that? How do you even enforce that and make that a reality? And you know, you walked us through that. So when was the first meeting of Congress?
1789.
So
they met in 1789 and 1790 was the first Congress.
And in that meeting, there was no mention of race.
Oh, the Continental Congress. No, that was that preceded the formation of the nation. And I can't remember the date off the top of my head. I don't want to give an inaccurate one.
Okay. And then the Constitution, this was before, obviously, 1681 was before the Constitution. When was the Constitution written?
Right.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
So what I'm saying is that most of our history is taught that not even the first meeting in Congress, it usually starts with just the Constitution. And you have to understand that this thing called race, this invention of race, this invention of white people, took 100 years prior to that to fester, to manifest. And it just didn't naturally appear. It was created, it was massaged, it was perfected. And that's what we really need to understand where we
exactly
are. Social Darwinism, this was perfected over time. And all from psychopathic people who wanted to protect their 1% position.
That's right.
So you and I are going to be doing a live show with Michael Kilman, because you guys together are just absolutely insane. The audience just loves your brains and your mind. And we're going to talk about social Darwinism, and we're going to be talking deeper into Linnaeus and Blumenbach, and how, you know, race emerged after these anti-miscegenation laws of 1681 took place. Give us some words of wisdom in closing.
Well, I guess I would like to just shout out a thank you for sharing that piece of information that I was unaware of until you spoke about it, that in one generation we really can change this.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I talk about this history and how deep it is and insidious it is, the workings of white supremacy, that is, I often feel overwhelmed, and I have definitely wondered, my God, how long is it going to take us?
Mm-hmm.
And it feels really empowering and really hopeful that's the case. But to realize that, we have a lot of work to do.
Yes, absolutely. I'll send you the interview, with my first interview with Dr. Edward Nichols that we did on that, and that as we were closing out, that's what he shared with us in terms of genetic memory and epigenetics. And I said, oh my God, really, one generation. So then I started counting and I started getting all the demographers together and started looking at what are the numbers. You know, what
right.
generation could do this? Because I know this is not going to be my butt because I'm getting ready. You know, I'm in my 50s. I've got less in front than behind, so it's going to be the next generation. So I'm like, okay, kids, let's go. Here's what we got to do. Here's your assignment of humanity. And that's really what we're talking about, your assignment of humanity. You come here, and it's not just to go to school and get a job and, have a family and all that, and that's phenomenal. And, yes, you want to do those things if that's what you want to do. But there's an assignment to your humanity, of humanity, and this is going to be generation-wide assignment of humanity.
Yes.
And
truly the greatest generation.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so I appreciate you, Dr. Battalore, for being with me as always. And we've got a lot more conversations to have. There's some things that you are working on that we're going to be releasing later in the year. One is a chapter in your book, but it's actually going to be the genesis of, I think, a new movement in America, and that is called Whiteness Competency. And I'm really looking forward to having that conversation with you and also being a part of the process.
Thank you. Me too. I look forward to it.
All right, everybody. You know what to do. Share this. Comment below and on Facebook, and we'll hear from you next time on the Philippe Matthews Radio Show. Take care, everybody.